Good afternoon. You're listening to AstroTalk. This is Marco, every Thursday at 3 p.m. The last few weeks, we've covered a few things called Death Stars. 2 weeks ago, something called a magnetar. A magnetar is a specific type of neutron star, which is the most magnetic object in the universe. So if human beings would come close to a magnetar, it would disrupt their bonds in their body, in the chemical elements, and the electron orbits would be disrupted. So that would spell the end of us. Magnetars also have such a strong magnetic field that they could, if they got close enough to Earth, they could erase all the data on our credit cards. So magnetars are dangerous stars. And one thing that's especially dangerous about a magnetar is the star quake from a magnetar. Inside the magnetar, the fluid circulates faster than inside in the middle, than the outer layers. So this causes readjustments in the surface, which is hard, and a star quake happens. So star quakes can lead to powerful emission of gamma ray bursts, and gamma ray bursts would affect our atmosphere and let the ozone in and disrupt the chemistry in our body. So that was one type of neutron star. The other thing we discussed was something called a Wolf-Rayet star, WR104. An astronomer, Peter Tuthill, in 2008 said this star's axis was pointed towards Earth. It's about 8,000 light years from Earth. But if it went supernova and if it became a gamma ray burster, then the gamma rays could destroy life on Earth. So those were two types of death stars. The first one, the magnetar, I talked about SGR 1806-20. It's about 50,000 light years from Earth. Okay, so today we're going to talk about black holes. And when I talk about black holes, I'm going to be talking about the type of black holes that are a result of supernova explosions. There's also huge supermassive black holes. One is in the center of our galaxy. Black holes are thought to have a role in powering our galaxies and in the formation of our galaxy. So the black hole at the center of our galaxy, the Milky Way, is about 4.3 million suns. So it's very massive. And scientists have measured other black holes in other galaxies that are 6, 7, 8 billion masses or times the mass of our sun. So these are truly huge black holes. Some of these black holes, when they accrete matter, when matter goes inside them, gamma ray jets can also come out of the evacuated poles. So the poles in the center of the black hole are evacuated, whereas if the black hole is consuming matter, there's a large disk. It's called an accretion disk. The matter rushes in. It's like a traffic jam. All the matter rubs against each other. So enormous heat is created, and then gamma rays are a result. So the gamma rays come out of the poles, out of the north and the south pole. They're tight beams that could be very powerful. They're the most powerful bursts of radiation in our universe. Okay, so we talked about the Wolf-Rayet star, which could turn into a gamma ray burst. And originally, Peter Tuthill thought it was pointed at Earth, but now they think it's 16 or 7. Its axis is tilted 16 or 17 degrees away from Earth, so we're probably going to be spared from this gamma ray burst if it happens. And we also talked about magnetars. So now I'm going to talk about a black hole and how it forms. And in the explanation, I'll talk about I'll compare our sun to as the sun forms and as the massive star burns its fuel. I'm going to make comparisons to highlight how powerful and how enormous these big stars are that form black holes. Okay. A few weeks ago, I started with someone called Chandrasekhar. Don't want to pronounce his first name. It's too long. But he was a 19-year-old from India. He was awarded a scholarship to study in London, England, under some of the most world's famous astronomers. So on his voyage on the boat from Delhi to London, Chandrasekhar calculated something which would later be known as the Chandrasekhar limit. So the Chandrasekhar limit was if a star is more massive than that after its supernova explosion, then it could crush itself out of existence or become a black hole. Now, in the 1930s, no one had heard of black holes. In our society, we basically accept their fact that black holes exist. So back in the 1930s, no one was ready to accept this, especially Arthur Eddington, the supervising professor of Chandrasekhar. So Chandrasekhar thought that stars could eventually squish themselves out of existence, which what happens in a black hole. After Chandrasekhar's theories came out and weren't accepted, we had World War II. So all the top astronomers, the scientists, were involved in projects during the war. So there was probably a 20-30 year period where all the best minds of the world weren't working on black holes. But in the late 50s and the 60s, scientists debated it, and even though some scientists didn't accept the concept, scientists did accept it. So now we're going to talk about black holes and what causes a black hole to form. So any star, again, here, now I'm going to talk about comparisons with our sun and the most massive stars, which eventually turn into black holes. But before this, I'm going to review again something called alpha, beta, gamma. These are symbols in the Greek alphabet, and they're important in astronomy for many different reasons. But for this discussion, an alpha particle is a helium nucleus without its electrons. So it's just two neutrons and two protons, so it's a nucleus of helium. In places like stars, the temperatures are so high, the ions become ionized, they become plasma, so the electrons are freed from the nucleus. So an alpha particle is a helium nucleus without its electrons. It has a +2 charge, an atomic number of 4. So this is important in the formation of stars. It has two neutrons and two protons. A beta particle is a beta minus is an electron, and a beta plus is a positron. So these are formed when fusion occurs in a star, and when the beta minus and the beta meet each other, they annihilate and turn into pure energy. So alpha and beta are particles, where gamma, it's a ray. It's electromagnetic radiation that that occurs in stars during their collapse and during their formation when they're burning nuclear fuel. So a gamma ray is important. It's a ray, it's basically massless, but it's got a very long wavelength, so it's the most energetic type of electromagnetic radiation. Okay, so now we're gonna look at how stars form. So this will lead us into how black holes form. So stars form from the gravitational collapse of massive molecular clouds in any galaxy. So for example, in the Orion constellation now, there's something called the Orion Nebula. So the nebula is Latin for cloud. It's a massive gas cloud, and in that cloud, some stars are now forming. And stars form, for example, our sun, it took 10 or 20 million years to form, 15 million years. So stars form from the gravitational collapse in these molecular clouds. So the collapse in these clouds is initiated by a few processes, could be initiated by a few processes, but usually initiated from the shock wave of a nearby supernova. So a supernova explodes, the shock wave surrounds an area of the cloud, squeezes it, so the particles in the cloud collapse in. So all the particles, mostly hydrogen, attract each other, and a big area of the cloud collapses inward. So gravity is the thing that makes the cloud collapse under its own weight, but it's the supernova explosion, the pressure from it, that initiates the collapse. So the cloud shrinks and heats up, and that's how our solar system formed. Most of the matter went into the middle, and it became a big disk, and in the outer disk, the planets formed. But 99.9999% of our solar system, the mass is in the sun. So the cloud shrinks and heats up, and its center eventually becomes hot enough for nuclear fusion. So fusion is when, for example, a helium nucleus, which is a proton, smacks into another helium nucleus, and they bind together. Usually a proton with a positive charge will not want to go next to a near to another proton because they both have positive charges, so they repel. But in the center of a star, the temperature is so high, they're going so fast that they collide. And if they get within 10 to the minus 15 meters of each other, which is 0.00000000000001 meters of each other, the strong nuclear force takes hold. So the strong nuclear force is present in the nucleus of the atom, and it's the thing that keeps the protons and protons together. And it also binds neutrons and neutrons and binds protons and neutrons. So we have to think that in an atom, there's mostly protons and neutrons. So why do the protons stay together? Because the strong nuclear force holds them together. So what happens in the core, for example, in our sun, 600 million tons of hydrogen is being fused every second. And there's a four-step process that it's four different reactions. Eventually, four protons will fuse to become a helium nucleus. So this will, in our sun, take something like 10 to 12 billion years. The core will burn hydrogen. In more massive stars, some stars are 100, 150 times as massive as the sun, they will fuel at a much faster rate. We would think that because they're bigger, these stars would, but because of the gravity really hard and the fusion works. So for example, the sun, fusion at 600 million tons a second, and it lasts for years. A massive star, 100 times as massive as the sun, it only lives a few million years. So we can only imagine how much, maybe there's trillions of tons of hydrogen that's fused into helium in its core every second. So after our sun and a big star that will eventually become a supernova, they will exhaust their hydrogen in the core. So all the hydrogen will eventually be fused into helium. So what happens is the star contracts further under the force of gravity into a hotter and denser state. Stars are quite remarkable because they self-adjust, they adjust their outer layers. There's all kinds of things that happen in a star that's just really remarkable. But anyway, after the core contracts under the force of gravity, so we can remember gravity's trying to squish everything in the core down to a point. So as it squishes, this matter becomes hotter and hotter, the helium, and finally, as a result, it begins to fuse helium into carbon. Now, this will happen when the core reaches a temperature of over 100 million degrees Kelvin, which is about 100 million degrees Celsius. So that's an amazing temperature, 100 million degrees. We cannot duplicate that on Earth. So what will happen is the core of the star will fuse helium into other elements. For example, helium has two protons, two neutrons, so it has an atomic number of four. It will react in different types of reaction to form carbon 12. So three heliums will eventually fuse to form a carbon. So this is called the triple alpha process. So this is what happens in our star and in a big star that will eventually become a supernova. When helium is being fused in the core, a layer just outside the core starts to fuse hydrogen. And so this will happen, for example, in our sun, in a tenth of the time. So the helium fusion, or hydrogen fusion into helium, takes about 10 to 12 billion years. And then the helium will fuse into carbon in about a tenth of the time. So what happens to our star is the maximum temperature our star can reach is at the core is 300 million degrees Kelvin, which is an amazing temperature. And at 200 degrees Kelvin or 200 degrees Celsius, carbon and helium can fuse in the oxygen. So our star will make some helium, but the core will be a lot of carbon in this second stage or third stage of helium of nuclear fusion. So to get to the next stage, to fuse carbon and carbon into magnesium, so carbon has an atomic number of 12. So there's 6 neutrons and 6 protons. So to fuse 12 and 12 into 24, that would make magnesium. So 2 carbons would make magnesium. In more massive stars, you need a temperature of 600 million degrees to do this, but our star will only reach a temperature of about 300 million degrees, or so astronomers believe. So what will happen, our star will not go on in the nuclear fusion process. It will turn into a white dwarf, something called a carbon white dwarf, and the carbon white dwarf will eventually blow out its outer layers, and it will just, the sun will end its life as a white dwarf. So carbon, compressed of this, is diamond. So what we'll have, our sun will turn into a huge diamond one day. There's other stars that are more massive than the sun that could turn into helium white dwarfs or neon white dwarfs, but to turn into a supernova would need a star that's at least 10 times as massive as the sun. This is Marco. You're listening to CRTR. We will now pause for a station break.
CRTR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Persian Song Club, Kids Boutique, Pacific Cinematheque, Birch, Birdside Pop, Meats, Vinyl Records, and Sushi Shop.
Welcome back. This is Marco on CITR. You're listening to AstroTalk. So I was talking about stages of star formation. So our star will end its life as a carbon white dwarf. Other stars that are a little bit more massive than the sun will either become helium, or less massive will become helium white dwarfs, or more massive will become neon white dwarfs. So scientists believe that any star that's, astronomers believe, that's 8 times or more as massive than the sun will probably, or 10 times, will probably end up in supernova explosions. Okay, so we will continue on now and talk about what form, how supernovas happen and how neutron stars and black holes form. So our star, the sun, it will reach a maximum temperature of 300 million degrees Kelvin, will end its life as a carbon white dwarf, so it'll be a big diamond. A grape-sized sample of that star would weigh about a ton, so it's going to be very heavy. Other stars have more mass, so they can continue on in the nuclear fusion process. So when the carbon is exhausted in the core, another core just outside the carbon is burning helium, and another shell, first the core is burning carbon, another shell is just outside the core is burning helium, and another shell beyond that is burning hydrogen. So when the carbon is exhausted, the temperature or the core stops fusion and it temporarily contracts. Again, the pressure and the temperature raises until reaches a temperature of 600 million degrees Kelvin, which is 600 million degrees Celsius, more or less, in the core. So carbon 12 plus another carbon 12 forms into magnesium 24. So magnesium has 12 protons, 12 neutrons, So this is how our elements are formed. They're formed inside stars. And the next stage is at 1 billion degrees, which is an enormous temperature. Oxygen, which has 8 neutrons and 8 protons, so atomic number of 6, it fuses with helium to make neon. And there's all kinds of protons that are hitting these nucleuses, so they will form, for example, an element 21, element 19. So this is how the elements are forged. The elements on our Earth, in our body, they're formed inside massive stars. So the oxygen burning process in the center of a massive star will continue, and then when the oxygen is burnt up, then again the oxygen in the core is burning. Outside the core, a shell of carbon is burning. Outside that shell is another shell of helium burning, and another shell is hydrogen fusing. So as the star goes higher and higher and fuses heavier elements, it resembles an onion with progressive shells burning different elements. So at 3 billion degrees, which is an amazing temperature, silicon starts to form. And at 3 billion degrees, there's a lot of gamma rays associated with this high temperature. So there's enough energy in these gamma rays to blast nucleuses apart. So the silicon, some of the silicon will be blasted apart, but some will not. Some will remain silicon. So some of these silicons that break up will break into 7 helium nucleuses. So this is very handy because silicon, which has atomic number of 28, can bond with these helium nucleuses to make different elements. So this leads to the formation of heavier elements. So what happens is there's multiples of 4. For example, 12, 6 is carbon. So it has 6 neutrons, 6 protons for atomic number of 12. Oxygen has 8 protons, 8 neutrons, atomic number of 16. And helium, atomic number 20, so it has 10 neutrons, 10 protons, and on and on. So for example, different elements like phosphorus 31, sodium 23, fluorine 19 can form from these other nucleus that are made that are multiples of 4, and eventually sulfur, argon, calcium, titanium, and chromium will form. So that's how a lot of the elements in our bodies and on our Earth are formed from these heavy stars. So the heaviest elements are born after the supernova explosion. So we're going to follow our star just before it explodes. So when it reaches silicon, it's 3 billion degrees or higher in the core. It's just an amazing temperature. When the silicon fuses with different helium and with helium, 7 heliums and 1 silicon will make iron. And iron can be formed from 2 silicons fusing. So when this happens, this is when the star will meet its death. Because before, for example, in the initial stage, when hydrogen fused into helium in a 4-step process known as the proton-proton cycle, it released energy. So this release of energy is what keeps the star in equilibrium. The gravity of the star tries to crush the star to a point, all the matter in the star to a point, but the nuclear fusion in the core balances this, and the star maintains an equilibrium. So throughout these various fusion staging stages, then, for example, in silicon, there's a lot of energy being released, and this energy will prevent the gravity from collapsing the star to a core. And the energy released is given by Einstein's equation, the famous one, E equals mc squared. So when when fusion takes place, there's a small reduction in mass, and this mass times c squared is the amount of energy released. So the star is kept in equilibrium by fusion and like an interplay between nuclear fusion and the gravity, which is trying to collapse the star to a point. So when the process of iron is reached, when iron becomes is made in the core, this is when the star faces its death, because all the other processes before, all the other fusion processes, released energy. But to fuse iron, the most stable of all elements, it requires an energy input. Excuse me, I gotta close the door. Okay, thank you. Now, so when iron is formed at the core, then it takes an energy input to fuse iron, and this won't happen. So all the electrons that previously helped in battling the force of gravity will be consumed in the iron, in the core. So what happens is the star has nothing left to fight the force of gravity. So as previously mentioned, our star will end up as a carbon white dwarf. There's not enough pressure, not enough mass in our star to squish it further. And a neutron star, there's not neutron degeneracy, which is some force from the neutron, will prevent the star from becoming a black hole. So 1.4 masses of the sun, that's called the Chandrasekhar limit. This is when a neutron star will form. If what's left in the core after the supernova explosion is 1.4 solar masses or higher, the star will form a neutron star. But if the star, what's left in the core, is higher than 4 solar masses, then it will become a black hole. So when the star, the massive star, forms the iron core, this will lead to its collapse, because iron requires energy input to fuse together. So in a matter of a brief fraction of a second, the core, which was tens of thousand kilometers wide, collapses in an instant and implodes. So in this implosion, the star will, there will be a rebound, and some of the mass of the star will explode out. This is called a supernova explosion, one of the most powerful explosions in our universe. And when the supernova explodes, radiation and light gets thrown out. A lot of neutrinos are thrown out, and in the resulting explosion, the temperature in the outer layers from this explosion will reach 100 billion degrees, which is an amazing, amazing temperature. So in this process, heavy elements like uranium, plutonium, all the heavy elements will be formed. So this is how the elements on our Earth are formed in our body in supernova explosions, because the star throws out all the elements it's made out into the interstellar matter. So these large molecular clouds, some of the stuff that's in them are from supernova explosions. So that's how the iron and all the other elements on our Earth were made in a big, massive star. When it exploded, it threw out all these elements, and this is why we have these elements on Earth. So now we have a core after the explosion. Some supernovas will blow themselves out of existence. And there's another type of supernova where a multiple star system, where two stars are in orbit around each other. One star will siphon off matter from the other star, accumulate enough of that matter, and it will blow into a supernova. But we're not going to talk about that. Just talking about the supernova explosions after the star has fused iron. So a magnetar, as I talked about before, in the 2 weeks ago, will form if what's left in the core after the collapse is between 1.4 to about 4 solar masses. If what's left in the core is beyond 4 solar masses, then we could get a nice big black hole. So in 1930-35, when Chandrasekhar proposed something like this, some scientists were ready to accept it, but a lot of them didn't know what a black hole was, couldn't believe it could exist. And again, during the war, all the minds, all the scientists, even astronomers, were used in the war effort. So there was 20-30 years of of lost time between the first time that Chandra Shekhar proposed his thesis that stars could squish themselves to a point. So this is what basically happens in a black hole, is there's so much mass that nothing can stop the collapse of the of all the matter into a point. So in 1939 and through the 50s, 40s, some people, some scientists proposed that stars could squish themselves to a point, into a black hole, but really wasn't until in the 60s and the 70s that the theories were accepted. So now we're going to talk about black holes, and an important thing about the black hole is its event horizon. So this is a radius around the black hole into which that once matter crosses its event horizon, it will never come out. So it'll basically exits our universe. So that's what scientists think. So in a lot of the discussion about black holes, scientists still don't have the physics to explain what happens inside a black hole, but we can talk about what happens when matter approaches a black hole. So first, what is a black hole? Scientists have defined it as a singularity, a singular region with zero volume and infinite density. So it's there's things called non-rotating black holes, which is a single point, and a rotating black hole, which is a smeared out ring singularity. So again, a singularity is an area of space with zero volume and infinite density. So we now are familiar with black holes. We even have jokes about black holes, like black holes are out of sight, things like that. Okay, so now we're going to classify black holes. They're supermassive black holes. These are black holes that are 100,000 to billions of times the mass of our sun. So they're quite small. All black holes are small, but the event horizons of a massive black hole are bigger. The event horizon is given by the Schwarzschild, I'll try to pronounce that again, Schwarzschild radius. So the Schwarzschild radius is equal to 2 times gm. So m is the mass of the black hole, g is a constant, it's a gravitational constant, over c squared, so c is the speed of light. So this defines the event horizon of the black hole. So again, the event horizon is the line, it's an imaginary line. If anything crosses the event horizon, it disappears in the black hole. So basically, it exits our universe, or so scientists believe. So the event horizon is a boundary in space-time through which matter inward escapes from inside the event horizon. So information in the event horizon I'm going to talk about two concepts called, world time, and that's one of the general relativity. So Einstein predicted some concept called space-time. So there's four dimensions. We usually thought about three dimensions, but Einstein talked about space-time as the fabric of space-time. So in large objects like a star, the space around the star becomes curved. So when objects or particles travel along this space-time in space, they're going to travel along these curves. So this was different than Newton's concept of gravity. So in massive in black holes, we're going to talk about something called gravitational time dilation, and also something how a black hole and affects light, or light that approaches a black hole and eventually crosses the event horizon. I guess that's a good way to talk about black holes, is talk about what happens when something approaches a black hole and crosses the event horizon, what happens to the time and what happens to the light itself. So again, I didn't mention this, but the limit of a black hole will form when, after the supernova collapse, if it's about 3.8 to 4 solar masses, what's left in the core, this is called the Tolman-Oppenheimer-Volkoff limit. And the Chandrasekhar limit, or the Chandra limit, is 1.4 solar masses. So anything that's left in the core after the supernova explosion, if it's 1.4 solar masses or higher, it will form a neutron star. And if it's 4 solar masses or higher, it will form a black hole. So now we're going to talk about gravitational time dilation. We're going to talk about not a robot, because a robot cannot think. We're going to talk about a person who's in an indestructible spacesuit who approaches the event horizon. So usually if a person would get within 3,000 kilometers of an event horizon, again, the event horizon is imaginary boundary in space-time. It marks the point where any information like light or a person or any mass, as soon as it crosses this event horizon, it will disappear from sight. We will not see it anymore. It basically exits our universe. So it's taken into the black hole. So any light that shined in, we will not see it anymore. Cannot escape. So we're going to talk about gravitational time dilation. So if we approach the black hole and its event horizon, then anything closer than 3,000 kilometers within the event horizon, it would squish us to death. And these forces of gravity around the black hole are amazingly powerful. I read once where a physicist talked about time travel. And the physicist said, I wrote, if we approached the event horizon of a black hole, hovered a few centimeters above the black hole for maybe a couple of years, our time is dilated, so it slows down close to a black hole. So if we hovered there for 2 years, we would return to our Earth, and 50,000 years would have passed on the Earth. So that's a way to travel into the future. But of course, it's impossible to get that close because it would squish us to death. So what is gravitational time dilation? Einstein said that in his theories of general relativity, when in the vicinity of massive objects like stars that have great mass, that time would slow down. But time would slow down for an observer, let's say on Earth, if someone was close to a black hole and they had a clock, and we could see that clock. We would see their clock slowing down. But they would not feel the slowing down of time. They would think everything was normal. The clock would be ticking just like normal. So this is one of the concepts, these frames of references. Even traveling at the speed of light, if someone's traveling at the speed of light, if we could see their clock, we would think that their clock is going slower. So as we approach the speed of light, observers in a different reference frame, let's say stationary reference frame on the Earth, we could see their clock slowing down. But they think their clock is just ticking like normal. So this is one of the things of special relativity. It's about the speed of light. But general relativity is about in areas close to massive objects with immense gravity. So as we approach the black hole, let's say an astronaut would be brave enough to fall into a black hole, then time would start to slow down from our reference frame. So the person would be, let's say, approaching the event horizon of the black hole, their clocks would seem to tick more slowly for observers outside. So if we on Earth could see this person's clock, we would think their clock is slowing down. This is called gravitational time dilation. So objects falling into a black hole appears to slow down. So what would happen as the person approached the black hole, we would look at their clock and think their time is slowing down. But to them, they would not notice this. Again, they would be crushed to a point by the gravity of the black hole, but we're assuming they're wearing a indestructible spacesuit. So as the person approaches the black hole, we see their clocks getting slower and slower and slower, ticking slower. But they don't notice this. If they looked at us, they would see our clocks ticking faster. So they would think something was wrong with our clock. So as they get further and further or closer to the event horizon, their clock ticks slower and slower. So we outside would think their clock slows down so much. So as they're crossing the black hole, their clocks would freeze. So we would never see them enter the black hole. because the time would slow down so much so it's like they could live forever. So this is called gravitational time dilation. So a person falling into the black hole does not notice this time dilation. So what happens then is we would observe this person. It would be in an infant, they could live forever because their clocks would just stop just as they're going to cross the event horizon. Now what happens to light when light approaches a black hole? So light has a particular wavelength, and our eyes can perceive certain wavelengths of light in the visible range. But there's other electromagnetic radiation that's longer than light, that's radio waves and infrared, and the ones that are shorter are the X-rays and the gamma rays. Okay, so what happens when light is falling into a black hole? We can call this a gravitational redshift. Okay, why is it a gravitational redshift? Well, we'll talk about that now. So photons always move at the speed of light, c. So according to general relativity, photons are attracted to gravity. But photons don't slow down, because if they do, they cease being photons, so they stay at the speed of light. But the gravity steals some of their energy. So as the photon approaches the event horizon, the gravity is stealing some of their energy. Since the energy of any electromagnetic ray is proportional to its frequency, this means as some of the energy is stolen away, the frequency of the black hole is reduced. Now, frequency is inversely proportional to wavelength. So as the energy is lost, the wavelengths of this light is increasing. So light coming from the vicinity of a black hole, it will be something called redshift, because the highest visible wavelength are on the red spectrum. So the wavelength would increase. So from our viewpoint, as light approaches the black hole, we would see it become yellow and then red. And as it moves closer to the event horizon, the light is shifted out of the visible spectrum into infrared or radio. So then telescopes can see that, but we could not see that. So at the event horizon, the light is shifted to infinitely long wavelengths just before it enters the event horizon. So the life would be shifted beyond our perception. So as the light approaches the black hole, it becomes longer and longer, changes color, and suddenly we just can't see it anymore. So clocks move slower as our astronaut is reaching the event horizon, and the light is being shifted to longer wavelength. So at the event horizon, the clock would seem to stop altogether, and the light would be shifted out of the visible spectrum. And light would be shifted, from our perspective, to infinitely long wavelengths. So at the event horizon, just before crossing, our brave astronaut, all action is frozen in time at the event horizon. That's how we perceive it. Also, when the astronaut is approaching the black hole, or the event horizon of the black hole, the tidal forces are so great that, let's say if he's going in head first, or she's going in head first, then the gravity would pull on the head more than the feet, so the astronaut would increase in length. So that's one way to become taller, is to go near a black hole. And our bodies would become skinnier. But before that happened, it would tear us apart, tear all our atoms apart. So an observer would never witness someone sinking below the event horizon. It would appear to take forever, and the light would be shifted out of the visible spectrum and beyond our perception. So as soon as the person crosses the black hole, nothing can escape. So when the person enters past the event horizon, then that's the point of no return. Nothing can escape back. So once they're in the event horizon, scientists believe space-time is curved infinitely. So light would bend an infinite amount. So if we're inside the black hole or the event horizon and we could still see ourselves, we could see the back of our heads, or the back of our backside, anything. So, but our present laws of physics break down. They're inadequate to describe the final moment of a star collapse and what happens inside a black hole. So quantum mechanics is the physics of things that are very small, And general relativity is the physics of things that are very big or massive. Scientists have been trying to combine the two to make quantum gravity to, and this could possibly explain what happens inside a black hole. But inside the event horizon, it's a place where the rules break down. Strange things occur there, and the physics that we know cannot explain these things. There's some interesting things about black holes. Scientists have done calculations. I can't explain them, but they say that wormholes could exist, so we could enter a black hole, and it would be a tunnel to another universe and to another place in our universe, in our galaxy. So what happens when you have a black hole? Mass warps space-time, and since black holes are so massive, it warps space-time infinitely inside the event horizon, and outside of it, gravity and time is warped. We can describe it by general relativity, but as soon as we enter the event horizon, then we can't describe it. Scientists believe that gravity waves could help explain something that happens inside black holes. Gravity waves are produced when mass accelerates, just like electromagnetic radiation is produced when things like electrons accelerate. So now we're inside a black hole. It's a singularity with infinite density. It's a point, and most information about the matter that went into forming the black hole is lost, and anything that enters the event horizon of the black hole is lost. So is the information lost in black holes? This has divided the theoretical physics community. They still don't know. So for example, now we're going to talk a bit about the physical physical properties of black holes. A 10 solar mass black hole, its event horizon would be about 3,000 kilometers. So if we approached the black hole within 3,000 kilometers, we'd cross the event horizon and nothing could come out. So when matter rushes into a black hole, we see this at times when black holes consume matter. This is called accretion. There's an accretion disk where matter goes inside the black hole. Let's compare this to the process of nuclear fusion. When nuclear fusion happens in the core of a star, about 0.7% of the rest mass of the elements that are being fused are emitted as energy. But during accretion, 40% of the rest mass of the matter is emitted as radiation. So this is the most thorough and efficient conversion of energy in our universe. So accretion disks and black holes can be accompanied by relativistic jets. So when black holes consume matter, in the poles, which are the evacuated regions, there could be two jets of radiation blasting out. So these are very dangerous if any of these jets would hit our Earth. So the first candidate for a black hole was Cygnus X1 in 1972. So black holes have been around for about 30, 40 years, even though they were proposed maybe 80, 90 years ago by Chandrasekhar. So there's a supermassive black hole at the center of our galaxy. It's about 4.3 solar masses. Astronomers have been tracking 90 stars moving around the center of our galaxy, and they're tracking how the black hole affects the motion of these. A few weeks ago on the news, I mentioned there's a gas cloud, G2 it was called. It's about three times the size of our solar system. It's now finally being eaten up by the black hole in the center of our galaxy. Since it's 26,000 light years away, this black hole, we're seeing what happened 26,000 years ago. But this is the first time scientists can actually visibly see what happens to matter as it falls in the black hole. So we can learn a lot about it. So what's the fact about the black hole? It's warps space-time around it, and light bends or deflects, and as soon as it crosses the event horizon, then mass and light exits our universe, or so scientists believe. But they really can't explain yet what actually happens. So black holes can continue to grow by absorbing additional matters, and black holes can also merge with other black holes. And there's So supermassive black holes are thought to form like this, and supermassive black holes are thought to exist in all regions, or in the center of most galaxies, and they're the things that power the galaxy, and they could have had a big part in the formation of the galaxy. So now we're going to talk about a different thing about black holes with Stephen Hawking. In 1974, Hawking proposed that black holes are not entirely black. They evaporate or emit small amounts of thermal radiation, which was eventually called Hawking radiation. Now, people didn't really accept this in the beginning, just like Chandrasekhar's theories. They really couldn't accept it that black holes could form, but eventually they did. So Hawking's proposed that black holes can shrink and evaporate over time. And it's strange, but big black holes emit less of this radiation than small black holes. So black holes do not emit any information, but we can rely on indirect observations. So whenever somebody like Hawking proposes something like this, this new theory in the 70s that black holes can emit irradiation, it was a novel concept. It took a while for it to get accepted, but I think he won a Nobel Prize for it, so it's accepted now. Let's talk about a few other properties of black hole. There's something called a photon sphere. It's a spherical boundary around the black hole. Its size is about 1.5 times the Schwarzschild radius. And its photons may move along tangents to this photon sphere. So some of these orbits, it will shoot out. But as soon as the photon enters this photon sphere, then it will thaw. It cannot escape the It's close enough to the event horizon. Well, the event horizon will eventually pull it in, and it will exit our universe. There's also something called an ergosphere in a black hole. It's an oblate disk in shape. It's a region where objects cannot remain stationary. So in rotating black holes surrounded by a region of space-time, it's impossible for matter to stand still. So this leads to something called frame dragging. So any rotating mass just outside this event horizon will be dragged along space, along space-time. That's a great concept, isn't it? So any object near the rotating black hole will move in this direction of rotation of the black hole. The effect is so strong that any object near the event horizon will have to move faster than the speed of light in the opposite direction just to stand still. But it cannot move faster. So the Penrose process explains that objects can emerge from the ergosphere with more energy than they emit it, so they can steal energy from the black hole. But the ones that do not escape, then they will go through this process of dragging. So then we've talked about a black hole, and when they were first introduced by Chandrasekhar, this concept, it was difficult to accept, but now even school-aged children accept the concepts of black holes. So the equations of Einstein, they break down at the event horizon of the black hole, and that's why the solutions give an infinite answer, and that's why scientists believe that a singularity exists, because the equations break down, but they're not really sure if this theory of quantum gravity, which merges quantum mechanics and general relativity, if scientists can come up with this theory, then it's possible they can explain what happens inside a black hole, and the equations might lead to the fact that there is no singularity. But for now, with that theory, a point of infinite density and very, very small area, even smaller than the size of electron or proton. So the singularities signal the breakdown, predicts them. Present laws of physics are inadequate to describe the star's collapse when they go in, or what happens inside a black hole. So singularities and black holes are places where the rules break down, and strange things. So we could have things like wormholes, time travel. We're not really sure until some scientists, maybe from UBC, will come up with these theories. So you have been listening to AstroTalk on CITR. We've been talking about black holes. And black holes are massive objects that warp space-time. They lead to time dilation, and they have strange effects on light. So thank you for listening. We'll talk to you next week.